delegation came with a message of willingness to move the relationship forward.
The top U.S. diplomat met with the top leaders of Pakistan. We'll talk with our correspondent there. This is Thursday, September 6th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of the program. Also ahead, another top U.S. official was close by in India talking about Afghanistan. Asians who have never had a country of their own find a place in the United States. And criticism of a Myanmar verdict against two reporters continues to spread. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met leaders of Pakistan's newly elected government in Islamabad Wednesday to shore up bilateral relations that have sunk to their lowest point in the past year. Ayaz Ghul covers Pakistan for VOA. He joins us now from Islamabad. Thanks, Ayaz. Now, speaking to reporters yesterday on Tuesday on the flight to Pakistan, Pompeo said his mission was for both nations to find a path forward together. Was that accomplished today?
Oh, well, that's a tough question to answer because both the sides, a lot of good things about their negotiations that occurred today, but there was no substantive statement that would tell us that they really have taken the relationship further. But there were pledges from both the sides that, yes, they want to reset the relationship and that they need to continue these kind of engagements to overcome the challenges that are causing strains in their bilateral relationship.
How contentious were the meetings? Were you able to get a sense of that at all?
No, that is an interesting part of the whole event or episode that happened today in Islamabad, that both the sides described their conversations, their talks in all the meetings, cordial, pleasant, and friendly. And as the Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi, just a couple of hours ago, he addressed a news conference. He put it this way, that the American delegation came with a message of willingness to move the relationship forward, and that Pakistan has given assurances that it is also ready to do whatever the United States wants and whatever is possible for Pakistan to promote a peaceful settlement in Afghanistan, which apparently was at the center of all the discussions. And in fact, most of the discussions took place about how to go about a peaceful settlement in Afghanistan.
What was the tone that you noticed between Imran Khan and the U.S. Secretary of State?
Well, what we understand from the official statements and from our discussions off the record with officials who were inside the meeting, that Imran Khan, in a detailed way, explained his reform agenda, which is aimed at fixing problems Pakistan facing internally, like dealing with extremist threats, dealing with the economic crisis, and other social sector problems. Because Imran Khan has been focusing on these issues, telling his voters that unless and until Pakistan's internal problems are fixed, foreign countries, including the United States, would never be at ease in dealing with Pakistan, whether it's economic cooperation or security cooperation. So that's what we understand he presented in detail to the U.S. delegation. And Pompeo gave, what we understand, a lot of attention to his words and, you know, praised his agenda. This was the first time that the Secretary of State Pompeo came to Pakistan to engage with leaders in Pakistan. And this was the first time for Imran Khan's government to engage with the U.S. at such a highest level. So the bottom line is that it was basically an introductory sort of engagement between the two sides, where both the sides were introduced to each other. But the overall atmosphere of discussion, what we understand, is was very friendly. And that is why Secretary Pompeo invited Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to Washington for a follow-up meeting to continue these discussions so that they can promote this engagement and can create a joint collaboration to promote primarily a peaceful settlement in Afghanistan, as I said, that was the focus of the discussion, and that is the real challenge the United States is currently facing, and that is where Pakistan's role, as Secretary Pompeo put it, is very important to persuade the Taliban to come to the negotiating table. The overall impression that we got from today's engagement is that there was an impression that the relationship, there was almost no diplomatic or political engagement between the two countries. And now that both the sides have pledged to take the relationship forward, it is good, overall for the bilateral relationship. This engagement seems to have done something positive in order to overcome these tensions, political tensions, and give a message to both sides that maybe they're really willing to go ahead and have some cooperation that will ultimately lead to regional stability, some stability in Afghanistan. But again, Afghanistan remains a very complicated issue, but at least in terms of bilateral relationship, this engagement is being seen with a lot of praise and appreciation.
BO reporter Ayaz Ghul speaking with us from Islamabad via Skype. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAAsia.com website. These are among the top stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Twin bombings at a wrestling training center in a Shiite neighborhood of Afghanistan's capital kills at least 20 people. President Trump says the United States is doing well in trade talks with China, but that Washington was not willing to make a deal along the lines of what Beijing was seeking. Japanese authorities now say 11 people are dead, hundreds more injured due to Typhoon Jebi, which disrupted land and air travel and left thousands of passengers stranding at a major airport, the airport in Osaka. South Korea's presidential office says a delegation personally met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un Wednesday and delivered a letter addressed to him from President Moon Jae-in. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said Wednesday he believes attempts to end the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan are gaining traction. Mattis spoke to reporters on a plane en route to India. VOA correspondent William Gallo is traveling with the secretary. Speaking from New Delhi, Gallo spoke with International Edition Sarah Williams.
Yeah, he was actually pretty positive about the reconciliation process between the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the United States. Of course, there have been preliminary talks between U.S. and Taliban officials, but those haven't been confirmed by U.S. officials. Mattis actually came close to that for the first time. He spoke of open lines of communication, so not an official confirmation, but clearly he is, you know, optimistic about where the talks are going. And, you know, this despite there being a lot of violence in Afghanistan lately, and of course the U.S. also continues, along with its coalition partners, to drop a lot of bombs. So there's a lot of violence, yet still I think some sense of hope in Afghanistan.
Now this conflict, though, has been going on now. The U.S.-led war has been going on 17 years.
I mean, so this is why I think you have to take some of these statements sort of with a grain of salt, if you will, just because U.S. officials regularly offer very optimistic assessments of the state of the conflict in Afghanistan. However, there is a sense that the new commander, the new U.S. commander in Afghanistan, is really in this to guide this conflict to a resolution-type phase. Of course, the U.S. is still dropping a large number of bombs. There's still a lot of fighting, but this is really, you can feel, moving hopefully towards something of a resolution now.
Well, meanwhile, Secretary Mattis also commented on there is an offensive apparently has begun or is getting ready to begin in Idlib, that Syrian province. What did Secretary Mattis have to say about the potential use by the government of Syria of chemical weapons?
Yeah, well, you know, this isn't new that U.S. officials have warned Assad against using chemical weapons, but what Mattis did on a slide here was say that, look, if this happens, it wasn't the Syrian opposition because we have zero intelligence. that Syrian rebels actually have chemical weapons capabilities. This was sort of a response to Russian officials and Russian media recently who have suggested that if there is any usage of chemical weapons in Idlib, it will be the rebels' fault. That is an accusation that both Assad and Moscow have made after prior chemical weapons attacks in Syria.
Secretary Mattis is in India. I guess you could say the relations between the two countries, they've had a long relationship, but there's certain concerns at the moment, particularly because India is buying oil from Iran, and it's also planning to acquire a Russian missile defense system.
Correct, yes. India has long considered itself, or at least attempted to be neutral in world affairs, especially between major powers. So, you know, most of their weapons are Russian-made. They also have very close relations with the U.S., and those relations are getting closer. I think this trip is an indication of that. This is the first ever, they call it a 2+2 meeting between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, and their Indian counterparts. So it's a signal that things are moving in sort of a warmer, closer direction, especially as the two countries sort of have their eye on China. But there are those concerns you talked about regarding India's continued purchase of Iranian oil. The U.S. obviously wants to cut Iranian oil exports to zero. There's not really much of a sense they will be able to do that, though. To get the pressure back to where it was during the Obama administration would take a lot of work, and even U.S. officials, when you talk to them, sort of acknowledge that this isn't going to happen. But they'll press the case. The bigger issue, perhaps, is the Indian planned purchase of a Russian missile defense system, as you mentioned. That could be something that is a somewhat major irritant in relations, although for sure not, you know, nothing that will derail the relationship altogether.
VOA correspondent William Gallo in New Delhi is speaking with our colleague Sarah Williams on VOA's International Edition program. Here's what's happening now in Asia. A powerful earthquake hit Japan's northern island of Hokkaido early Thursday, collapsing walls and some buildings, but not triggering a tsunami. 11 members of Afghanistan's dreaded Haqqani militant network have been arrested in Kabul, according to the Afghan intelligence agency, who said Wednesday, a day after the announcement of the death of the group's founder. And the wives of two Reuters journalists sentenced to 7 years in prison in Myanmar have made a public appeal to the county's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to help reunite their families. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. And we are happy you are with us. In Minnesota, Hmong farmers have banded together to make a better living. Originally from China, the Hmong are an Asian ethnic group that migrated to Vietnam and Laos in the 18th century, but they have never had a country of their own. After the Vietnam War ended, many resettled in the U.S., and now, decades later, Hmong farmers are at the center of a local foods economy in Minnesota. VOA's June So has more in this report narrated by Carol Pearson.
On a Friday, Mi Hang picks flowers to sell at a local farmer's market over the weekend. Mao Mua and her husband pick vegetables, also for a farmer's market.
We bought corn, sweet potato, then gao cherry, cucumber, snap pea, had a little bit of cherry tomato, that's all.
Hang and Mua's families were among a mass exodus of Hmong people fleeing Laos for Thailand in the 1970s. Ever since they resettled in the U.S., they have been farming in Minnesota in recent years on a membership farm.
I like farming on the Hoffa farm because this is a Hmong association. There are Hmong workers who help us. They are like our hands, eyes, and ears. I like there is also water, electricity, and the food hub.
So happy.
Since 2011, the nonprofit Hmong American Farmers Association, also known as HAFA, runs the 63-hectare farm outside St. Paul, Minnesota. Member farmers have a long-term lease on 2 to 4 hectare parcels to grow their vegetables and flowers.
One of the reasons why Hafa was created was because the Hmong farmers were experiencing so much uncertainty, but they didn't always have access to land. So when you don't have land tenure or land certainty, you can't actually invest in organic certification. You can't invest in perennials, which actually have higher profit margins.
Pako Hang was born in a refugee camp in Thailand and came to the U.S. with her parents in 1976.
During the Vietnam War. In Laos, my father joined actually a secret army that was allied with the United States CIA. But when the Vietnam War ended and the communist faction came into power in Laos, they actually began to target Hmong soldiers.
With more than 60,000, Minnesota has the second largest Hmong population in the country.
Within the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Hmong farmers make up about 50% of all produce growers selling at the farmers markets. The Hmong growers' participation in the farmers market has really revitalized the farmers market.
Hafa also operates an alternative markets program called Food Hub.
Our Food Hub is a place where we aggregate our Hafa farmers' produce and then we distribute it and sell it to different institutions such as schools, co-ops, or restaurants. And then we also have a CSA program or community-supported agriculture that we have about 350 currently members that they get a weekly subscription of produce.
Hang says Hmong farmers have fueled a freshly grown local food movement.
Hmong farmers are major contributors to our local food economy and to our overall economy. I mean, studies have shown that they produce over $250 million in sales.
Hafa's business development programs help the farmers to get micro loans to buy tractors or new farming equipment. But Hang says all the programs are not just for income generation.
What we're really interested in, what we are focused on, is actually wealth creation. And not just intergenerational wealth, but community wealth.
For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Dakota County, Minnesota.
Coming your way, the U.S. Vice President has some very strong words for Myanmar. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, motorcyclists without helmets have been barred from buying fuel in Dhaka, an attempt to quell tensions after major protests for better road safety in the Bangladeshi capital last month. The Japanese car giant Toyota has recalled more than a million hybrid cars globally due to a technical problem which could, in the worst case, cause a fire in the vehicles. About 1.03 million vehicles built between 2015 and 2018 are being recalled for safety checks. The affected models include Prius, Prius PHV, and CHR. And Indonesia will raise import taxes on more than 1,000 goods, ranging from cosmetics to appliances and some cars, part of measures aimed at cutting imports and supporting a weak currency. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence called on Myanmar to immediately release two journalists who were sentenced to 7 years imprisonment on charges of possessing state secrets in connection with their reporting on massacres against Rohingya Muslims. Walone and Kwas So-U from the Reuters news agency were sentenced Monday in proceedings that were widely decried as unfair. They had reported about the army's brutal counterinsurgency campaign that drove 700,000 Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh. That court decision in Myanmar has triggered waves of outrage, both inside the country and abroad. The U.S. and the United Nations and other governments around the world say the sentence is a blow to Myanmar's transition from military rule and to freedom of the press worldwide. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
Family members of the two reporters were devastated by their seven-year sentence, but they put on a brave face for their sake.
We are still fighting for that, and we will keep on going. We have to make strong.
Hopes were high after Myanmar appeared to embrace democracy in 2016, naming formerly jailed opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi to be its civilian leader after decades of military rule. Attorney for the reporters warned the harsh sentence would have far-reaching consequences for the country formerly known as Burma.
This court conviction is not only bad for our clients, Hua Loan and Kwa So Oo, but it will also tarnish the country's image around the world. Consequently, it will have a negative impact on democratization, including rule of law and freedom of expression in the country.
The two journalists were covering the military attacks that have driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims from Rakhine State to cross the border into Bangladesh since last August. The harsh sentence may also be meant to send a message to other reporters, Reuters editor-in-chief told VOA.
It seemed like an effort to prevent them from reporting on a very powerful story they were working on about a massacre of 10 individuals.
The United States is calling for the journalist's immediate and unconditional release, saying the verdict marks a sad day for press freedoms and the country.
I think it's sad for people who've worked so hard here to promote media freedom.
Marcial said it would be up to the people of Myanmar to assess whether the sentence bolsters or diminishes their confidence in the country's justice system. Siddhi Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news alert from VOA Asia: a district in Indonesia's deeply Islamic Aceh province has banned men and women from dining together unless they're married or related. Officials said, he added, this would help women be more well-behaved. President Trump said he has completed negotiations on a new trade deal with South Korea and may sign it at the United Nations General Assembly this month. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. A new study warns more than a quarter of the world's adult population, or 1.4 billion people, don't get enough physical exercise, putting themselves at great risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, dementia, some cancers, and other health problems. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the World Health Organization report, the first study to estimate global physical activity trends over time.
The study, which surveyed nearly 2 million people in 168 countries, finds the level of physical inactivity has remained fairly static between 2001 and 2016. The World Health Organization says people are not moving around enough, and this is a cause for concern, especially among women who are less active than men in all regions of the world except for East and Southeast Asia. The report finds the levels of physical inactivity are more than twice as high in wealthy countries as they are in low-income countries. Lead author of the report, Regina Guthold, says the study also documents a wide range in levels of physical activity for countries across the globe.
Ranging from as low as 6% in Uganda and Mozambique to 67% in Kuwait. Four countries had a prevalence of inactivity of over 50%. That's Kuwait, American Samoa, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. And this all refers to the year 2016.
In explaining the difference, the report notes people in wealthier countries are more likely to engage in sedentary occupations, to use computers and digital devices for recreation, and to travel long distances. On the other hand, it says people in poorer countries do more physical labor and have less access to motorized transport. The report recommends people do at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of vigorous physical activity every week to stay healthy. It urges governments to provide and maintain infrastructure that promotes increased walking and cycling for transport, as well as sports and recreation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you have been listening to VOA Asia. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, managing editor, Diane Gallen, our team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great evening.